Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Michael Melsky, a filmmaker whose credits include Growing Up, Charlie's Own, and Perfume War. His latest feature is The Child Remains, a psychological drama starring Suzanne Clément and Alan Hawko as a couple who discover their quaint country getaway hides a terrible secret. Already on screens in Nova Scotia and Alberta, it's opening in Toronto, Vancouver, and St. John's this Friday, April 18th. Michael picked The Changeling, Peter Medak's profoundly creepy 1980 ghost story starring George C. Scott as John Russell, a composer who sequesters himself in a creaky old mansion after the deaths of his wife and daughter, and soon becomes convinced that the property is haunted by an unquiet spirit. I could run through the rest of the plot, or I could just mention the piano, the rubber ball, and the wheelchair, and send those of you who've seen the movie into screaming fits. Winner of the very first Genie Award for Best Canadian Film, it's also been invoked in conversations about the scariest pictures ever made for almost four decades now. The Wheelchair. This is someone else's movie.
It's probably my favorite Canadian horror movie. And it's a huge influence on The Child Remains. I actually rewatched it over the weekend. I've seen it a dozen times, but I didn't realize how much that movie was in my head when I was writing and directing.
Well, when I saw The Child Remains in the fall.
Like, yeah, you saw the festival cut, right? Yes.
And as soon as you said you wanted to do The Changeling, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but, absolutely.
Yeah, but it's not a slavish reproduction or anything. It's just...
No, it's a tribute,
the
really.
The mood is the same.
Yeah, the mood is the same. You know, the idea of buried secrets. Mm. I mean, that sort of tied in perfectly with the real Butterbox Babies story in Nova Scotia. In the literal unearthing of Joseph Carmichael in the well. I mean, you know, it's also really an interesting film because of, you know, its Canadian-ness. It's arguable Canadian-ness.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's just, I guess, to bring listeners up to speed, it's from the tax shelter era.
It is, yes.
It was when you could make any movie in Canada as long as you figured out how to finance it.
And exactly.
It was a bunch of dentists, right?
Exactly. Who expected a return on their investment.
Yeah. This was one of the Drabinski ones, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Mary Kassar. And the, you know, there's so much fun in it because they had a decent budget. They had like about $7 million, I think, which even today would be still a decent budget.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have a story that even if it's mostly financed, you know, by dentists, it still feels like just a real piece of Canadian lore, even though all of its roots and antecedents are from the U.S.
Yeah.
George C. Scott, you know, General Patton, terrified by a bouncing rubber ball coming down the stairs. I love their use of wide angle. I read Ebert's review, and he didn't like the wide angles and stuff. I found it incredibly creepy. I mean, they milk the 14mm lens.
It's disquieting.
It's disquieting, right? Exactly.
Something isn't right, even though there's nothing... And the lack of visual effects, you know, like the fact that it's actually pretty minimalist for a horror movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just... I mean, now you look at stuff like The Conjuring and the slow burn horror films that are sort of reclaiming that.
Mm-hmm.
They still fall back on a big booga booga CG scare or something reaching out of the darkness where there couldn't be anything. The thing that I remember being freaked out the most by in The Changeling is that there's nothing there, and yet the tension never goes away.
Exactly. There's always the sense of something is watching, something is, there's a sense of dread around the most mundane scenes. Like, you don't even feel safe when you're at the Historical Society in that film.
Oh, yeah, they have nothing. They're not going to help.
Exactly. It was all, you know, it was my favorite era, too, of horror. It was the era my dad raised me on. You know, we just spoke about Jaws as we were setting up here.
Yeah.
You know, Rosemary's Baby probably was the beginning of that in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That
kind of occult wave that...
Yes.
The Omen.
Exactly. The Exorcist. The Exorcist. The Shining. The Changeling, you know, we were well into the slasher era when The Changeling hit. And But it still stands the test of time. Someone just posted something in the AV Club a few months back saying, is The Changeling the scariest movie of all time? And it was an argument. Hey, what do you think? Can we make an argument for this? I was like, you know, it's nice seeing that movie get its due. I remember I was asked to participate in naming Canada's top 10 films. And there's quite a few filmmakers and critics and programmers on it.
Oh, this was the TIFF thing. Yeah, I was part of that.
Yeah, and I put The Changeling on there. I also put Atlantic City on there, another tax shelter film.
That's a good one.
I was like, yeah, it's those were, you know, I think if in this day and age we can celebrate the Canadian-ness of Room.
Sure.
You know, disingenuously, then, you know, we should certainly reclaim and not be ashamed of, you know, our participation in the tax shelter films. We're just as Canadian as...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, as anything.
I mean, launched Cronenberg, they launched Reitman, yeah. Cannibal Girls was a tax shelter
Absolutely. Porky's, Black Christmas.
Sure. There's always one or two valid reasons for any fad. And
seriously.
In this case, it was just a tax incentive that ended up launching a movement, launching careers.
It's true.
Jobs.
And, it's so true.
Yeah. And this is... Is it the scariest movie ever made? It's certainly the scariest of the tax shelter films.
I would say.
There's a lot of horror, but...
I would say.
This one's... I think it's probably the scariest movie of all time if you see it at the right age.
I would... Yes, that's arguable. Absolutely. I agree with that. It's a hard question. It's all so subjective, but... I enjoyed reading that for that, you know... As a Canadian, yay. Gay Canada. We can do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we're finally reaching an era in Canadian film finance where we don't have to be ashamed of making really, you know, thoughtful, character-driven, story-centered genre films.
Sure.
Like Get Out was a huge success this year with The Shape of Water, which has a very large Toronto connection.
Sure, right here, yeah.
Yeah, and... you know, I hope we'll continue to celebrate that Canada's ecosystem can have all kinds of different movies in it, different kinds of movies. They don't have to be highbrow, you know, Berlinale, you know, films. They can be, you know, there's many different kinds of quality.
Yeah, and, I mean, genre in itself is not a sin.
Exactly.
There's literally no reason not to treat horror or science fiction or comedy as lesser than, right?
Yeah.
People do it all the time, which isn't fair. I watched The F Word again this weekend. A friend of mine was in town from Scotland. She was staying here and hadn't seen it. And it's like, well, this is a really good Toronto movie. Why don't we actually look at this? And it was my fourth or fifth time through. And it's just, I think it's really great. I mean, I always liked it, but it's one of those films that gets richer the more you see it, the work that went into it.
And yeah, it's very fun.
The huge cast, and most of them are locals. And every time I watch it, I was saying this on Twitter, every time I watch it, I notice one more person who has since become famous in a small role in The F Word, because we have that many talented people.
That's so cool. It's like our American Graffiti.
Yeah, it kind of is now, weirdly enough. So... With The Changeling, you have a really small cast. I mean, I was kind of surprised at how minimal it is. I remember it as being really small and quiet, except when it's terrifying. But it is really, like, it's on Scott's shoulders.
It's very concentrated. You know, it's really, you know, and the elephant in the room is, of course, the supernatural presence that... You know, Scott spends as much time in conflict with that, which is mainly sound driven for the most part. And that wheelchair, you know, that wheelchair is one of the scariest props ever conceived.
Yeah. And it's so simple.
Yeah. So simple. Like the rubber ball, the wheelchair, the music box, these things all, you know, become characters that he interacts with as he is compelled down into the well of what happened here. And the seance scene is you know, still one of my favorite scenes in horror history. It could have gone so wrong, and yet it was so right. And it's just still stands out.
Yeah. So how old were you when you first saw it?
I don't think I saw it in the theaters. my dad really pushed the boundaries with me. And when I was growing up in Sydney, like I was firstborn, I was his movie buddy.
Yeah.
So he would, you know, take me to, you know, Jaws. He tried to get me into the Deer Hunter, and the ticketeer was like, no, no. I think I got in to see The Shining, which was a miracle. You know what? I think my dad took me to that, actually, The Changeling. That's the first time I saw it. And he, we both loved it. It was just really, it was just a genuinely, I remember, you know, having this creepy feeling right away. So
yeah, I caught up to it. I think I saw it on pay TV first time.
Really?
First choice of Super Channel or whatever it would have been in the early 80s. I missed it theatrically. I think I probably, if I'm being honest, I probably talked myself out of going.
Yeah.
Everybody was saying how scary it was.
Yeah. It's yeah, it was the trailer. Remember the trailers? The voiceover?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The Changeling.
Stentorian, it was like, disturbing.
Yeah, that stentorian thing. Yeah. It was something I had to go see. I mean, my dad pushed the boundaries. There are a few things. I wanted to see Cronenberg Shivers back then.
Right.
Even the ad scared me on that one. I mean, when we were doing The Child Remains, I knew I wanted a really powerful, iconic image, like the 70s films used to have. Like It's Alive, like Rosemary's Baby, for Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, the It's Alive trailer scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
I was eight.
It's just genuinely, it's like those are the formative years when you get warped. I mean, my little brother was just, you know, he was the tag along. He's 7 years younger than me, but he wanted to. By the time VCRs came along, he was 10 years old. We were watching Halloween when it came out on video in the mid-80s. Right. And my brother was like, I want to watch it. Chris, you know, I don't think you should do this. He's 41 years old now and still hates jack-o'-lanterns. He's still very disturbed by Michael Myers. Like,
I mean, I don't blame him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, Halloween in 78 was, I mean, that was one I definitely wasn't allowed in. But I remember people talking about it, which only made me beg my father to take me more.
Right. That was usually my response too, but something about The Changeling, I don't know, it's the, I'm fine with everything now. I love the genre, but The Changeling was one that was just like, I'm going to have to sit and watch people wait to get scared. It's that kind of movie where it's just going to be creepy and creepy and creepy. And I don't like those movies. It's not that I'm afraid of them, but I take no pleasure in watching someone stand around and wait.
Yeah.
And because it's just a matter of timing. And
yes.
That becomes math, and that's less interesting than art to me.
Yes.
But then I finally watched it and it's like, oh, this is actually really good.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just the marketing made it feel like exactly the kind of movie I don't enjoy. But it turns out, no, it's actually really good.
I hear you.
I mean, that happens. I've had to see all the Insidious movies and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's torture. I don't enjoy it.
I'm not a huge fan of that style.
Yeah.
You know, the Blumhouse Smog, they've been very successful with it.
Sure, and sometimes it really pays off.
Yeah.
First Paranormal Activity is great.
Yeah, it's very, very good. Absolutely. And the audiences are being built up toward an expectation of you know, kind of a formula, the way that we were having talks at Hot Docs last night about that there seems to be like a formula developed, a nascent formula for a Netflix original doc.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I think audiences are getting a little bored with the jump scare formula, like that they come at you in such a predictable way that, you know, but you know, I felt like, you know, I wanted to use those elements very sparingly.
Mm-hmm.
And sneak up on the audience.
Yeah. It's not what The Child Remains is about.
Exactly.
It's not what The Changeling is about.
Exactly.
And The Changeling takes pleasure in disturbing imagery rather than a jump.
Exactly.
That ball comes at you slowly. You have enough time to wonder where it came from.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The wheelchair kind of bursts at you once or twice.
Yeah, yeah. The wheelchair, it's like one thing I realized when I was directing it is that there's an arc. There's an arc to horror that as a viewer, I'd sort of been aware of, but there really is an arc to scaring the audience. I mean, it's separate from a screenplay structure. It's separate from, you know, how a director maps the emotional beats. There's an arc of scares, and you need to be very precise about what you want the audience to be scared of? What level of fright do you want them to be at? Suspense, dread, any given time, in order to really maximize the moments that you want to be maximized.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a musical scale, really, right?
Yeah, it is. Very like that. Yeah, it's rather than, you know, which, you know, some of these, you know, Hollywood style, you know, movies are basically throw everything at the wall and if we get a few scares out of it, we'll get good word of mouth on Twitter, and we'll have a decent, you know, opening.
Yeah, all you want, you know, is the first weekend, and
yeah,
so the rest.
So exactly.
But was it the Friday the 13th films, right, that had the formula of every 7 minutes someone had to die, there had to be a kill.
I'm not aware of that, Norm, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Towards the the fourth or fifth, I think, is when it
locked
itself down.
The first one in 1980, I believe. 80, yeah. It's still my favorite of those. Speaking of, you know, Star Search, I mean, like, you've got like Kevin Bacon in there. You've got a couple of other famous young, who went on to be famous.
Yeah. Wasn't it? It's the fourth one that has Crispin Glover and Corey Feldman.
Yeah, that's right. So it's, yeah, but I remember that one was quite, you know, it had a scary start, you know, someone was killed early, and then it was quite a lull, not a lull, but
it's calm.
Calm,
yeah,
like,
I mean, it's establishing,
sneaks up on you, you know something's going to happen, but it makes you wait for it to happen,
and
that can be very potent, and I like that style.
So. Yeah, first one's like an orgy when it happens, like an orgy of murder, it's just death.
Yes.
But until that happens, you spend a lot of time wondering why you're watching the film, and which is like, it's good when the character work is solid and there's stuff to hang on to.
Yeah.
The later ones are just like, well, we need to kill someone around now, so let's introduce a hermit.
Yeah.
Or a cop. Seriously. Or, you know, those secondary characters who you've never seen before, you'll never see again.
Seriously. And that's, you know, Scream was such a reaction against the formalization of horror, and you know, that you knew he was going to die right away. You knew that was going to happen. You know, the 70s, you know, precursors to the Changeling, you know, Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre was, you know, a revelation, because, you know, it was shot like a documentary, which presaged Blair Witch, but it was that sense of just, you know, dread on a low budget.
Yeah.
That made so many filmmakers, you know, myself included, when I finally ultimately did get to see it, inspired by, you know, you don't, especially in the East Coast too, normal. You know, we've had such issues with the tax credit being cut, and trying to prove our worth of the government and still make films that they're kind of the kind of movie that we can make even without a lot of resources.
Sure.
We could contribute to Canadian culture, you know, even with stripped resources and even at the, you know, even having to defend ourselves against our own government.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, that sort of stuff is supposed to inspire creativity, right? In every myth you hear, it's when things are bad, that's when the art gets good.
Yeah, that's true.
But
yeah,
you can do it without starvation wages and stuff.
Ideally,
right?
Ideally, yes.
There's a way through. And certainly the stuff in the best horror films is rooted in, you know, humanity, anxiety. Rosemary's Baby is a great example. There are no special effects until the eyes at the very end.
Exactly.
And the dream sequence, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's about something that's totally relatable. It's about a woman trying to figure out if she's okay.
Yeah.
And if her baby is okay.
Absolutely.
And then I'm thinking of, well, Get Out's another terrific one where it's all about paranoia and social conditioning until it isn't. Then it's a monster movie.
Yeah.
And, and The Changeling is about dread. Like, it's about...
Yeah.
It's like a... It's, I mean, just... The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is actually a great comparison because they're both about a bad house. Ultimately, like, that's what it comes down to.
That's right.
The space is poisonous, is toxic.
Yeah.
And figuring out why is the big mystery for The Changeling, but also, emotionally, we're trapped in a bad house. You can't...
Yeah.
You know, you can totally understand why they don't just leave.
Yeah.
In Chainsaw, it's because they can't.
Yes.
And in The Changeling, it's because, well... It would be dumb to leave, right? Like, the characters are fighting their own conditioning there. It's like, I'm not going to be spooked out of my own home. Even though he has every reason. He's got
a tragic
past that's weighing on him. He's got grief and dread. And Scott somehow, going as big as he goes, manages to be vulnerable. And it's a really weird thing for him to do.
It's so true. I mean,
As you say, it's like watching General Patton go crazy.
I've enjoyed his performances, from, Anatomy of a Murder, like right through his career. He's just a terrific actor. Mm-hmm. One of the greats, I would say. He feels like he needs to solve this mystery. He steps outside of himself to, I think re-embrace his daughter, who he lost tragically in the opening few minutes, through the entity of the child, and it is vulnerable. Yeah. And another great character actor, Melvin Douglas, in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's such a, from HUD through God, so many great roles, and he's the scene where he and Scott face down is just riveting. It's like you can tell these two guys are like, even if this movie doesn't turn out to be scary, I'll get to act with this other legend.
Yeah.
For this one great scene, and it is really, really powerful.
So. Yeah, and there's a pleasure of performance that we can take out, but it's also they're not selling it as stunt casting or a joke. Like, they're really committing.
Yeah, they're just being character actors. And yeah, which is so cool. It's something we don't get to see enough of these days.
Yeah. And you mentioned too, I was trying to figure out how to fold it in, but the through line emotionally about losing his daughter,
mm-hmm.
gives Scott something not just to play in the movie, but it also leads into this whole other aspect of horror films or films about the supernatural, which no one ever talks about. It's always unstated within the movie and the conversation around it. But it was something that came up when I was discussing Signs with Kat Angus and Jocelyn Getty on their podcast.
Signs?
Yeah.
The show. And my channel? Yeah. Oh, really? Interesting.
Well, because by making the character a minister and having him lose his faith when he loses his wife, the idea of that film's ending is basically God sent signals, which is fine, but it's meaningful to the character specifically because if the supernatural is real, if God is real, then heaven is real, then my wife, I will see her again. And that's clearly what's driving Scott, is the idea that his daughter isn't gone.
Yeah.
But it never comes out. It's never articulated.
That there's a sense of a spirituality.
He's looking for meaning. He's looking for clarity.
Yes, yes. That's very interesting. Well observed.
It makes it more tragic, right? And I'm sure he's playing it.
Yeah.
Because he was right at that point, too, with things like Hardcore. He was playing Broken Fathers a lot.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. He
seemed to be in that pocket.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about the production. I really wish I did, that there were more stories about it. But it's because of the tax shelter thing. It was sort of treated shamefully. There's not a lot of history about a lot of those movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd love to know what, like how he and Medak approached it. And
I would seriously love that. I mean, I glanced at Wikipedia just to remind myself of some things, but yeah,
it's all pretty thin.
It is pretty thin. I guess, there was some, Medak was the third director. Yeah. I can't believe he won it. Like, he had a very interesting career. Like, you mentioned the Ruling Class. The
Ruling Class.
And then Zorro the Gay Blade a few years later.
Species 2.
Yeah, seriously.
But he also made The Craze.
Yes,
Which is tremendously good. With the Kemp brothers.
Absolutely. The Craze is so good.
Yeah. Written by Philip Ridley.
Yeah. That was the one, the Spandau Ballet movie.
Yeah.
The two guys. Right. Yeah, that was excellent. Gary Martin. Very underrated.
Yeah, only one of whom is still an actor.
Yeah.
It's a great together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, no, but he went, and I think Romeo is Bleeding too was one of his, which is this really messy kind of attempt at post Tarantino stuff, but it didn't really work. It's got a great performance from Lena Olin as like a velociraptor. She's a monstrous.
I'll have to check that. I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, check that out. Gangster person.
He's still making movies, I guess. He's no obituary. He's 81.
Oh, good for him.
He was directing on Breaking Bad a couple of years ago. So
that's right. I remember being really surprised when I saw his name pop up.
So, yeah, I was always under the impression it was mostly shot in Toronto, but I guess only the university scenes were shot in Toronto. Yeah, mostly Vancouver and Victoria.
Yeah, that surprised me too.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't look like BC.
It doesn't. It doesn't.
It's cold and, I guess it is cold and damp sometimes, but it feels more wintry, it feels more...
Yeah, I always sort of imagined it was like in some, a little alcove off... Hyde Park or something, like, one of those little warrens where you drive down a lane and there's this big creepy house.
Yeah, I figured it was out of town, like, you know, 20 minutes north.
Yeah.
Like where they shot most of Agnes of God
or
what was the other one? Oh, The Brood, which is that kind of isolated Toronto urban, suburban
thing
going on.
You can still tell you're in a city, but you're not.
But there's trees and a big footprint.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
For the house.
So, it's, you know, the other cast, I mean, not a hugely Canadian contingent, but
they imported
John Colicos is always great to see in a movie. I mean, him and Frances Highland, I mean, were in all the Canadian movies back then.
Yeah, they were the go-tos.
she was in Happy Birthday to Me. I mean, you knew, she was like one of those things, like you're watching TV and it's like, this is Canadian. I know her.
Yeah.
You know, but she's so good, and what a great character actress. And
oh yeah, no, everybody's doing exactly what's required. Nobody's
absolutely.
Nobody's phoning it in. Nobody's winking.
Exactly.
It's either because, I guess, I know Scott could be pretty intimidating as a co-star, so they're just bringing their A game.
I imagine, yeah.
Or it's, you know, it's the job, and they're doing a good job of it. Yeah. There was always, I guess it probably starts with the script rather than the director, but there's always a sense with, well, something like The Kidnapping of the President, which was shot in Toronto around the same time, is just garbage and everybody knows it. And it's one of those films where you're watching people sleepwalk.
Yeah.
Or, oh, my favorite example, that was the one I couldn't remember, Starship Invasions.
Oh, God.
Which I'm sure you saw, right?
Because
we're about the right age. I saw that theatrically. That was,
I know,
the worst.
I was just, my friends and I saw it. We were like, what the hell was that?
Yeah, if anybody's listening, Starship Invasions is probably on YouTube. It's absolutely not worth purchasing. But there will be clips of it because Christopher Lee wore a big polymer suit and talked telepathically through the big bulge on his head.
And it's just so lame.
Unforgivably bad.
Not even Planet Nine bad.
It's just bad. Yeah. No one's having any fun.
Yeah.
You can't take pleasure in it, and it's this whole plot to make the people of Earth commit suicide by an alien ray, but it's bad. But that was shot in Toronto. It was made by people who were completely dead inside.
Yeah.
And it's, from the word go, like, the costumes are lazy somehow. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
And with The Changeling, you have people who aren't approaching it as a thing that will be churned out as part of this assembly line of Canadian productions. It's a movie.
Yeah, it was made, you can tell it was made with, you know, integrity and a real purpose. A purpose to scare you. A purpose to tell a story. A purpose to, you know, lead with character and lead with story. And the scares were even more palpable because you actually cared. There wasn't any cheesy dialogue. It was, you know, it was it's a great touchstone for a filmmaker in the, you know, 2018, like, you know, as the world's starting to turn a little bit back toward that. I mean, we went through torture porn, now we're in Jump Scareville. You know, it would be nice to, and refreshing, I think, for audiences to, you know, embrace story again. Yeah. And The Changeling, if you're listening, is a great place to start exploring the history of Canadian horror.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's not forgotten exactly. I think the trailer is still floating around the internet, freaking people out.
And the score is so inspirational to us when we were scoring our movie.
Yeah, so you said it was an influence, but how closely do you feel you drew on it?
Wow.
Because this sort of folds into the key question of the podcast.
Yeah. Very influential. The structure of the film, I mean, it begins with, you know, a terrible loss. It gets your attention right away. Mm-hmm. And I must have been in my mind when I was writing The Child Remains, because it was like, I know the audience attention spans are so short right now. Festival programmers' attention spans are short. Like, and I also have a short attention span. I love film, but I love when a movie grabs me right away. I love when I feel like I'm in the control of the film and I can relax and buy in. And so The Changeling certainly has that. And then it, you know, it gets into its story fairly quickly without a lot of preamble. Mm-hmm. I was definitely influenced by Scott's musician character, Alan Ocko's musician character in my film. Yeah. I mean, the piano key going down in the empty room was a definite homage to The Changeling. The way that the music box is played in The Changeling as little Joseph is being drowned is what the song that Alan thinks he's composing in The House in The Child Remains is the same song that Rose turned on to drown out the sounds of her smashing the baby's head against the door. I was very, you know, it wasn't like conscious, like, here, I'm going to do The Changeling now. I mean, I did. If you go in tight on some of the shots of the wine bottles in my film, you know, one is Carmichael Valley Estates.
Right.
You know, there's another one called Myers-Strode Estate. Family Myers-Strode Family Estate Winery.
So they worked it out.
I love these drinks. So, yeah, they worked it out. The score was... The Changeling score, if you just listen to it without any images, it's a scary score. And it uses many different sounds and voices. Like, there's a little, you know, it's a goth, it's very gothic.
Yeah.
Very piano driven.
Well, it has to be ornate, right? Because the character is a composer and it has to reflect that. You couldn't just
pass it. Precisely. And I remember going to Asif, my composer, and saying, okay, there's two scores really we're gonna look at. This, The Changeling.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm about 5-6 tracks on YouTube. I said, before we start even talking, you're gonna listen to this. And the other was The Fog. Carpenter's The Fog, which is another great, I think underrated in his sort of canon.
Yeah.
But I loved it. It's still up there with Halloween. And it was such a maritime story. Mm-hmm. And in our film, we couldn't mention Nova Scotia for legal reasons.
Just so you're Butterbox adjacent, kind of?
So we had, yeah, like we couldn't, you know, it's just for protection, you know, frivolous litigations. Mm. So I wanted the Maritimes in the film. And I said, you know, wherever we can get the Maritimes in this movie, and it's not that hard because, I mean, it looks like Nova Scotia in the late fall. I mean, yeah. The trees, the...
Well, the sweaters, right?
The sweaters.
It's a specific look.
Exactly. And the wind. We have a very chilly wind. And The Fog had a very beautiful maritime score that evoked the sea. Those were the two scores that we really built from. And I had a wonderful composer. I mean, he could, you know, create... One of the sounds I wanted was the Aztec death whistle, which is one of the creepiest sounds you'd ever hear in your life. It's made from a human skull originally, and the Aztecs would blow into it when they were about to have a human sacrifice. And people have learned how to make them or to recreate them.
Right.
And it's just a terrifying stuff. Like, you know, it's hard to be fresh. Like, as much as, you know, I wanted to do a tribute to the great 70s films, you always have to find ways to make it fresh for, you know, audiences have seen, horror audiences especially, are so jaded.
Sure.
They've seen so many different movies. It's like, you know, I know I wanted to go in with, you know, this is based on true events, and it's not just a spurious inspired by true events. And we did move things around in the timeline of the ideal maternity home when we were creating the Mercy Home. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was, you know, that and, you know, as many fresh elements as we could get into it, while still keeping our integrity and not, you know, being way out there in terms of, you know, what kind of movie we wanted to make. Right. We knew what we were making.
Yeah.
And it was like, stay close to the antecedents, like The Changeling, Rosemary's Baby, The Orphanage.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And again, you know, like the real conflict is between the characters trying to figure out if they're losing their minds or if something is after them or truly happening.
Exactly.
And that stuff is the good stuff.
Like, yeah. That's the psychological stuff. Horror is really fun to write, and actors love it. I mean, it's the only reason with our budget we were able to get Suzanne. Hmm. We have the same agent, but Suzanne is very picky.
Yeah.
And very good, very talented.
I remember when she was here for my internship in Canada, she was saying she basically had to be lured to read the script because it's like comedy. Oh, I don't want to do it. She was just completely not interested in the genre, and then suddenly she's doing a great job.
Oh, she's just capable of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's like, you know, characters, actors, especially when they're successful, like Alan and Shelley and Suzanne, they can be tempted by a good story and dimensional characters.
Sure.
That will get them on set. And George C. Scott is another, plays a somewhat weaker character. I mean, for a guy who played, you know, Patton and some of the other great roles he's played, The Hustler.
Sure. I mean, even Strangelove, right? I mean,
even Dr. Strangelove. Oh, God.
Like an upright, big energy role for him.
How did that not be in my head at this moment? Of course. They don't like to play weak. And they, you know, my limited experience writing for stars of various echelons in the constellation, they don't like to play weak, especially male characters, unfortunately.
Sure.
I would think, you know, some of the great roles, I mean, essayed by Daniel Day-Lewis, who, you know, loves to play weak, flawed characters, you know, would be an inspiration. But
vulnerability is still a hard sell.
Vulnerability can be a hard sell, even in this enlightened era that we live in. And so we see in George C. Scott's Changeling and Alan Hocko, you know, I was like, I love the actor. I thought we were friends. I thought he might be interested if he was not too busy. He was right in the middle of shooting Frontier.
Okay.
He was a saint. He loved it. He loved the script. He loved the character. He stopped, basically. He was a producer on Frontier, and he altered the schedule of Frontier to come and do our film, nice. Which is really, really cool. And he's such a cool, nice guy. Him and Susan are so nice to work with. And it was a weak character. Like, it was...
Well, he's uncertain.
He's uncertain. He's vulnerable.
Yeah.
He's attackable by the, you know, underlying evil in the house. And, you know, as much as it's a, you know, a dialectic between two strong women, you know, it takes two genders to make a baby. And I felt like, what's the male, how does the male element fit into all this? How could we, you know, how can we explore how maleness is involved in this very female story?
Right.
And Alan carries that. And yeah. And I'm really happy that he came on board.
Yeah. Yeah. So now we just have to come up with like a digital hologram of George C. Scott so you can cast them together and see where that goes.
Seriously.
I'm in. I'll watch it.
Seriously. Well, you know what? Norman, we're going to have to wait too long. You know, holograms, are they? You'll be watching movies, they'll be right here.
Yeah, performance capture presentations and things. We're killing art.
Seriously, like, yeah, I still think films are born in a set. They're born in collaborations with real people, not in After Effects. You know, your Final Cut Pro. Like, you know, there's a place, there's good things can be done with all that.
Sure.
But always in service to, you know, a higher purpose storytelling, which is why we're all still making movies, so watching them.
Oh yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And also, it's just scarier to watch people. You know, CG, you can always tell.
Yeah,
puppets are fun. Digital effects have their place, but yeah, it's not as interesting to me to watch. Even, you know, like even with something like the Marvel movies, when it turns into software fighting software, it's just less interesting. It's a program playing out.
I'm so with you on that. So with you. As we opened against Infinity War this weekend. Yes, I am so with you. Like, I can't, like, I enjoy comics as much as the next kid growing up, but I can't watch that. It's just not real to me.
Yeah. It has its moments. It's still better than the DC movies.
I heard. I have other critic friends who've said it's actually probably one of the best of that family of films. Yeah. But
I like Civil War more.
Yeah. So they're gonna keep making them. It's like you build it, they'll come. And they will keep coming. And Hollywood will keep making those things.
Yeah. And so we get to have smaller movies as an alternative.
Well, yeah.
Counter programming.
Yeah, and it's like, you know what? I'll put my storytelling up against theirs any day of the week, but it's the marketing dollars they have. I mean, marketing budget is like probably as much as Canada's gross domestic product, you know. And we're trying to get the word out with, you know, a very modest marketing budget. Thank you, Telephone Canada, if you're listening. But we're also, you know, it's 50,000 against, you know, 55 million probably. So, yeah. You know.
Well, it's a good fight to fight.
Thank you, Norm. I appreciate it. It's a good fight to fight. It's the only fight I think we can make right now.
My thanks to Michael Melsky, whose new film The Child Remains opens in Toronto, Vancouver, and St. John's this Friday, April 18th. Thanks also to Angie Power. She knows what she did. You can find Michael on Twitter at Michael Melsky, all one word, and you can find The Changeling on DVD from HBO Home Entertainment. It doesn't seem to have ever made it to Blu-ray or any streaming services, which is a shame. Shudder should pick it up. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. The Wheelchair.